And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Well, hello, Phil Lairness. How are you?
I'm doing, why lie? I mean, I've been watching the Emmy Awards, so I'm ready to stick my head in the oven. unfortunately, I fear that sticking it in the oven would only cool it off at this point. It's still so hot here in LA.
Oh, see, it's, spring is in the air here in lovely Australia. There's a gentle wind from the Arctic, Antarctic, no less, and I am getting my Emmy news sent to my morning inbox and my email. So
you can't wait did to open that. Not watch it live?
No, because that would have been on at 4:30 in the morning, I think. Or maybe or somehow. No, I did not.
And because you didn't want to risk sleeping that soundly and and then missing the alarm and not walking the girls in the morning.
That's exactly it. Somehow.
How exactly do we celebrate excellence in television broadcasting by putting on the most boring program? I mean, I know slamming award shows is, it's shooting fish in a barrel, and it's every award show gets criticized. We criticize every single award show. But, I mean, this was the most fundamentally awkward and dull, lifeless event I've ever seen. Ever. And, ever.
Yeah. Well, here's what I think the problem is. There was a time before the internet where you only got to see your stars, quote unquote, in glammed up outfits. I was on a red carpet on a award show once a year. And then the rest of the time, you have to go see them in a movie theater, act their hearts out, and do all that sort of thing. Now, we could see them walking their dogs, holding their kids, going to the groceries daily on the internet. So we don't give a crap when we see them all glammed up and getting an award. And
3 hours of them holding their kids would be more interesting. than what, especially because when they hold their kids up, I would like to hear who they thank. It's terrible. And when Fox hosts it, it's kind of the worst. And you would think of any network, they might be the ones to really be able to put on a good show, the Fox network, to let all the stops out, really, do some interesting stuff. But they are handy crippled by a couple of things. One is the fact that they have no hosts on their network, no entertainment hosts, right?
Right.
I mean, they've got sports hosts, of course, they have football, but they don't have it does make a difference when you have someone in the active habit of hosting, a la a Seth Meyers last year, versus an Andy Samberg, who's a very funny man, who can read off a teleprompter, we learned.
Right.
But who's acting in a sitcom, and that's exercising a quite different set of skills. I don't even imagine that he's performing live on a regular basis anymore. So,
right.
It was, so that was disastrous. And then the other thing about Fox that I find is really peculiarly specific to them when they host the show. I'm sure each network does it, but it just becomes all the more obvious to me when Fox does it. The presenters have no correlation with the awards. They really are just the stars of Fox's upcoming fall series.
Yeah.
But they don't mention that. But they don't mention it. That's the other thing about it, is it's the elephant in the room, but they won't actually address it, you know, as stars of the upcoming series.
Well, this is when you learn that award shows are really promotional products. They're three-hour commercials. And if you didn't know that till today, I guess that's a belated spoiler alert. But, you know, back in the day...
I did know this, of course, but...
You did, yeah, okay, good. Then back in the day when Fox bought TV Guide, which for you kids out there was a magazine we used to look at to see what was on TV...
Some of us bought it so that we could get the collector's edition covers, where if we opened the flap, all three of the lone gunmen were there, along with Krycek and Smoking Man. Anyway, but please continue.
Well, they decided the year they bought that to have the TV Guide Awards, which was an award show that nobody had ever heard of before that they created. And only people who won it were actors from Fox TV shows. So, again, you thought...
That's brilliant.
Isn't that brilliant? So you go, oh, I see. This is nothing more than a self-congratulatory pat in the back, and award shows mean nothing.
It is fun, though, that now the Emmys get broadcast back and forth. They get traded around from the big four networks so that we can watch HBO shows win everything, no matter what network gets on. I don't really care about who won and everything, but I will say, I don't want to deal strictly in the negative about this. Largely, I want to whenever there's an awards show. But let me say this. At a time when all we really read about is how hard it is for women in the business, and indeed it is, how numbers and opportunities for women seem to be declining rather than increasing, it was nice to see that half of all the directing awards went to women, and who were, we must say, in fairness, the only females nominated in those categories. So they faced stiff odds, but excellent that that their work was rewarded, and perhaps maybe just the act of these producers and these networks winning Emmys because of the work of these women directors will lead to other opportunities for hiring women directors. But one of the men who won a directing award, none other than David Nutter.
Wow, I missed that. What did he win for?
Game of Thrones.
Ah, fantastic. Yes, David Nutter, the good luck charm for every pilot ever made, and director of many an X-Files episode, including ones that I've been in.
We spoke of him when we did our two-part analysis of subtextual and mythological and dream meaning in X-Files, I Want to Believe. We mentioned David Nutter.
Right, absolutely.
Because, of course, he was referenced in that film. Also, the big thrill kind of, the two big thrills of the evening, one, Tracy Morgan appearing on stage 1 year after Jimmy Kimmel issued the challenge for him to get well enough that he could appear next year on the show. And Tracy Morgan was there with the line of the night in the Emmy Awards. I'll let people look that up. And and John Hamm, finally, his last shot to win. Wow, the dogs loved hearing the John Hamm.
They're
big John Hamm fans.
Yes, absolutely. We've been watching Mad Men, so they're all up on that.
Well, I mean, his work, unbelievable. His work so good throughout that show. And he, in his last chance to win for that role, and in his 16th nomination, 16 nominations for Emmys, he finally wins his first one. So that was quite nice. But I would like to say this, because, you know, we talk a lot about how they change the rules, and so shows go from dramas to comedies and back and forth and limited to full series and all these things. The category definitions seem to change at whim each year. One show that was quite popular from Netflix last year in the comedy category was in the drama category this year. And so it made me realize, as I sit down to write my next spec script, that maybe if I position it for television, I will double my Emmy chances in the drama category if I write a script that is an episode where one of Tatiana Maslany's character's clones gets sent to prison, and I can call that episode Orphan Orange is the New Orphan Black. Are you with me?
Orphan Orange is the New Orphan Black. It's got comedy written all over it.
Oh my God. All right. It's late here in Los Angeles, and I'm running on empty. And if you could see me, you would know I'm enjoying a very hot cup of coffee. Dean Haglund, speaking of female directors, it's your turn to champion a film directed by a woman that everyone should see.
Well, should everyone see this one? Perhaps. I certainly enjoyed it. It was called High Art by Lisa Cholodenko.
You threw me a curve. That was not the one you said you were going to see.
No, I know, because the one that I was going to see suddenly was unavailable in my country.
Well, this is not on the list of recent women-directed films that everyone should see. This comes from the Film Fatale's list of women-directed films that inspired the work of Film Fatales. The work of women directors everywhere. High Art from the 90s is really a cornerstone of 90s independent cinema from Lisa Cholodenko,
absolutely,
who won an Emmy tonight for best directing the HBO film Olive Kittredge. Do you have your hand literally on the pulse, Dean Hagel?
Oh my gosh, I guess I do. I'm psychically connected to the Emmy Awards.
This is the film, again, for historic context, that gave us really Patricia Clarkson. I mean, Patricia Clarkson had been acting, had been doing nice character and supporting turns and everything, but this really gave her a chance to show what a fierce performer she was. And it was because the film was pitched and promoted as Ali Sheedy's big comeback, but instead of really it being a comeback for her, it was the real launch for Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah, she plays Greta, the washed-up German film actress who has a heroin habit, and so amazing, like the depth of character. And at times you think, wow, that German accent is either really put on or completely weird, but so works. I mean, it's such a big risk that she took with that character, and it pays off in spades the way it almost steals the movie, frankly.
It's been many years since I've seen, I mean, it's been almost, I guess, 19 years maybe since it came out, a little bit less than that, but and I saw it, really quite near when it came out. Does it feel like it captures a time and a place? I would imagine that it did.
It does. Yeah. It feels now very much like a period piece of, the 90s, 90s filmmaking, commenting on late 80s, early 90s. It's sort of based on Nan Goldin's career, who was a photographer in New York who got, caught up in the
LGBT
world of New York in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of her photos, Nan Goldin's photos, became, very much the icon of the nightlife of New York 70s culture. So I think this movie was supposed to be kind of a take on her career sort of thing. And in that way, absolutely, it does capture a lot of 80s and early 90s feel to New York. But at the same time, it does not feel at all dated. It feels like it was made yesterday, but that the art direction and the period detail was just that good. So hats off to, again, all of the performances and the directing on it as well.
It's not, if I remember correctly, it's not what one would call necessarily a fun film.
No, no, it's definitely art house. It's, a tale of an art film. What is she? She runs a magazine. She's an assistant editor at a trendy photo magazine, and finds a reclusive Ali Sheedy, who's a photographer who's gone into retirement, and she's pulled out of retirement by this assistant editor, and a relationship ensues, and drama unfolds after that. So
drama,
plenty of drama in this one.
Well,
and I looked up. Do you realize Lisa Chelyadenko's career started as a post-production PA on Boys in the Hood in 1991. So for all of those kids out there slaving away in a horrible PA job, think that your future still could look bright.
Absolutely. Look, the hardest part about the business is that there is no set way to make it wherever it is you're desiring to go. In this case, mm-hmm. let's say the director's chair. But the best thing about it is there is no set way. So
exactly.
Say yes.
It's weakness. Weakness is its strength.
Say That's yes right. to an opportunity and learn from it. And if you're the sort of person that does learn and you're the sort of person that shows up for other people, I think you may very well have a shot at getting where you want to go.
Absolutely.
I wanted to, I've seen so many films, but I've not had the opportunity to talk about two independent films that came out towards the beginning of the summer here in the States. One of which got great notoriety, deservedly so, but had slipped kind of through our Chill Pack Hollywood Hour radar. But might turn up next year when we look back at the best of 2015. One is the horror film It Follows.
And, oh, yeah.
Yes, this is from David Robert Mitchell, and it's about, I guess we could say, high-risk sexual liaisons among horny teenagers. Doesn't that sound like a familiar setup, right? That's 80s horror films.
Right, but Cherry Falls.
But this is based on a series of nightmares that the director had, where he would have these encounters. The writer-director is David Robert Mitchell, and he would have these encounters, and then something, some unnamed force, would be following him because of it. And so in this movie, if you have sex with one of the people who's being followed, that which follows suddenly starts following you and leaves the other person alone. And when it catches you, it will kill you, and it will then go back to the previous person unless you pass it on by having sex with someone else.
Wow.
So much has been made of this as a metaphor, an allegory for obviously sexually transmitted diseases. I think that's an easy read. I think it's unintended, though that doesn't make it necessarily irrelevant, because as we know, the artist's intention is only one part of this. But I think it overlooks the more nightmare aspect of it, that as you just said, that which wounds us heals us, that kind of thing. The strength becomes the weakness, right? Well, here is a case where remember, these are all coming of age kids being introduced, because that's the age where you think you're going to live forever. And suddenly the act of sex is what gives them a sense of their own mortality. And the answer to free themselves from the fear of that mortality is to have more sex. And so it's this very interesting loop about how those very basic human instincts lock us into a fear of death, but also offer us the escape from that fear.
Wow. Now there's a metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's an exploration of that. It is very scary. It is wonderfully done. I won't say it's the scariest movie ever, but it's one of those movies where when it's not being scary, how many horror films can you say that when it's not being scary, it's every bit as interesting as it is during the moments when it's scaring you?
And, yeah, that's very few.
And the other thing you'll love about it, Dean, is you find yourself asking, wait a minute, when is this set? Because I'm seeing someone with an e-reader, and yet every television is an old tube television and it's square. So when is this set? And suddenly it dawns on you that there is absolutely no technology that allows you to date this piece. It is all times and it is no times. And even though there's an e-reader, there actually is no modern technology in it. Because the e-reader is an old clamshell makeup compact that they turned into an e-reader. It doesn't exist.
Okay, that's fantastic.
So they wanted it to live in this realm of dream. I think, you know, you would agree with me when you said, wow, this guy was clearly influenced by David Lynch, but it's, you know, it's... And I'm not opening this up for an insult on Lynch. You don't have to pile on. But it's Lynch. Okay. It's Lynch with a conscious intent. You know, bringing a conscious intent to extrapolating those dreams on screen.
That's fantastic. Now, how close is this movie to the actual dreams he had? Do you know?
That I do not know. But, man, it would be fun to get this guy in an interview.
Sure would. I would love to hear if those dreams were manifesting themselves from, you know, perhaps guilt and or of a horrible past relationship that then turned those things into the dream that made that movie a reality.
Now, one of the movies that it keeps getting compared and contrasted to is a movie that I think made my top 10 last year, or at least was one of my runner-ups, a horror film from down under your way called The Babadook.
Oh, The Babadook. That's right.
Another female-directed picture. Of great excellence. And it drives me nuts that, one, these two films constantly get compared and contrasted. I guess because they're independent films and they're horror films. But that's it. That's what they have in common. And what's worse is everything comes down on the side of It Follows and says, oh, it's every bit as scary as The Babadook wanted to be but wasn't. And these movies... they both live in the realm of dreams, so I guess there's a common theme. But it's just, it's stunning to me because I've never heard people compare two comedies and said, oh, well, this one's funny. That comedy. Don't see that successful comedy. See this one because this one's funny. You know, it's like they can all be funny, right? They can all exist. Good is good. And The Babadook is good. But it is totally apples and oranges. And I think it maybe shows, again, a bit of... One, either distaste for the horror genre, or two, the protectiveness that certain critics feel for the horror genre in having to pit two very good movies against each other, whereas The Babadook is much more contained. It's contained literally geographically. It's contained metaphorically. I don't want to give anything, you know, too much away about it, but... In what I described about the allegory, the metaphor of It Follows, you see that it is this primal universal metaphor and allegory, whereas The Babadook is much more specific and rooted in something in the home, something involving motherhood, something involving, you know, womanhood. So anyway, I champion both those films, but It Follows is such a great deal of fun. And I don't know the last time maybe I saw a horror film where maybe the last time was actually when I saw the Japanese The Ring, Ringu, where I, as soon as it was done, I couldn't wait to watch it again.
Wow. That's amazing.
Another. So, but, yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, now I'm just thinking about what you said and of comedies and horrors. And you're right. They say, well, here's the best, funniest comedy of all time and the scariest movie of all time. And they rate those. And yet nobody goes, well, I'm just going to watch one comedy.
Right.
But everybody does go to the scariest movie of all time just to get as frightened as possible.
And are there really that many intelligent, crafted, you know, horror films that are scary, that have a worldview, that have a message, that are really, you know, directed with intent, with conscious intent? Are there really that many of them that we need to pit them against each other?
No, of course not. But it's just the way we consume our fears, the way we consume our laughter, two different mindsets, clearly.
The other independent film that I was glad to finally catch up with that does, again, it comes from Down Under by way of New Zealand.
Look at that.
Co-directed by Taika Waititi. The director, the filmmaker who brought, I think it was it Boy, which is the biggest hit in the history of New Zealand, but also co-directed by Jemaine Clement, one of the creators and stars of Flight of the Conchords.
Yes.
And it's a comedic vampire documentary called What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, yes. I saw this just a couple months ago.
Oh, my goodness. Now, look, there's no way that any film could live up to how funny the first 20 minutes of that movie is, you know, especially when it's a mock doc kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But every time you think, okay, they're out of gas, oh my God, it gets funny again. And it gets funny again because some of the actors in this are doing great character work, not the least of which is Jemaine Clement.
Jemaine Clement, I know. That's fantastic. And how they stay committed throughout the whole movie to the idea that their three vampire roommates who
they're flatting. They're flatting. It's basically a reality show about the perils of flatting.
Yes, exactly. And it's hilarious and the problems that they get into. And again, yeah, it seemed that there were like lulls in it. And yet I would watch it again and again. And I watched it with Gary Jones, of course, the hilarious Gary Jones from Stargate SG-1s. He turned me on to this and we watched it together. And, you know, there were nuances, comedy nuances that you could pick apart and just treasure in this movie that requires actually repeated watching.
Well,
and
you know, the thing that they did that I love so much in any movie, and, you know, it's funny because they gave it more care than a lot of horror films do or a lot of comedies do, which is that they set up rules and they played by them.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. The vampire rules.
They believed in, as outrageous as it was, they set up the construct of the world and they played by the reality of that world.
And that made the comedy even more so. Like, I can't even think of an example, but by staying within that, they were put upon by the world that they were in.
Well, I'm so glad that you've seen this because we were going to take a few more moments here to continue to celebrate the art and discuss the commerce of supporting players, supporting actors, character actors. We talked last week a bit how it's such a different world than the golden age of Hollywood where actors who were on contract could really hone their craft playing character roles film after film after film. And maybe they would get a bigger role in one, maybe they wouldn't, but they would really get to build and deepen as actors, as character performers. And nowadays, the commerce of it is, look, you're trying to build up to get a lead, and if you don't get a lead, well, then your earning potential has fallen off. There seems to be a certain, dismissal of you in favor of, well, let's give a supporting role to the next big thing, right? We're always looking for the next big thing for these smaller roles, or we're looking for someone who did reach to the top of the mountain and now is taking a juicy character role in between going back to leading roles, right?
Right.
And as we talked about, a lot of these actors, great character actors like a Paul Giamatti, they become lead actors then, and after a while, they seem to develop habits that now stand in the way of them going back and doing that great character work that made them successful in the first place.
Yeah.
But here's a movie, What We Do in the Shadows, where, talk about Jemaine Clement. I think this guy is actually a reliable go-to character performer. Every movie that I've seen him do, of course, the series Flight of the Conchords, this guy brings it. Even when I think I know what Jemaine Clement does, he makes me laugh. He surprises me every time.
Yeah. But do you think that, character actors are about range, and I don't think I've seen enough range from him to know how far he's going to go.
Well, maybe that's true, but you know, You go back to the golden age, and a lot of these guys, you know, the Walter Brennans, for example.
That's true.
You know, you did cast them as quote unquote a type, but they brought a real humanity to it. They brought something that was needed to make you believe the world. Jemaine Clement is one of those guys where if you have created a really bizarre, almost a lunatic sort of world and reality you want us to believe in, Jemaine Clement's a great actor to inhabit that world because he'll take that crazy landscape and he'll play it to the hilt as if it's the real world.
Yeah, well, that's true. And that, to me, is what made Flight of the Conchords so great, was this struggling band, but he played it so earnestly that it made it all the more funny the more pathetic the band circumstances became.
So really, I looked at the actors, the character actors, not supporting players, character actors that I find reliable or inspiring time after time, no matter what they're doing. One of them is one of your favorites. And looking at my list, I think they all are people that kind of bounce between leads and supporting, even if the leads are maybe on television. And that brings up the first one, Lee F. Schreiber, who's one of your favorites.
Yes, absolutely. We all know him for his first coming to our attention with his fantastic Orson Welles impersonation in
RKO 281, I think.
RKO 281, yeah, spectacular.
Ray Donovan, of course, he's the lead in, but right now in cinemas here in America, he's playing Boris Spassky in the Bobby Fischer Boris Spassky story, Pawn Sacrifice. And he is terrific. He is just electrifying, and it is very much a supporting role. But the thing about this, of course, is when you've got a great character actor, no matter how small the role is, those character actors are the leads in their own movie. Does that make sense? Like, you know,
absolutely.
How they're playing it in their mind, it's their character's movie.
Well, and often that's what you have to do. You create your own backstory for your character, a lot of subtext, and how you got to be this scene. You will often, in your own mind, write something. And if that's the case, if you're so committed to that backstory, you are in your own movie till you come into the scene with this other guy who's in another movie, and suddenly you're both in your own movie, as it were. It's a great way to think of it.
Another one that I had that I mentioned the other week when I just said it's ridiculous how good this guy is, and can we just give him an Oscar already, is Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon played the lead in Take Shelter, one of my top films of the decade, and what I think might be the best lead role of any actor all decade. And he's Oscar worthy again in 99 Homes. The performance it's supporting. It's incredible. Of course, he was worthy of awards and won many awards when he was a supporting player in that story about the Runaways, the rock band, the Joan Jett rock band. And of course, he gained a big following for his supporting turn on Boardwalk Empire. So he's one of those guys that really is just ridiculously good. Every time, no matter how different the characters are.
Yeah. Well, you know who I like then in the same thing, but it's hard. Let's discuss the career of David Morse.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We know him from Green Mile and Hurt Locker as a supporting guy and great character actor. He's always the cop you go to, the corrupt cop in 16 Blocks with Bruce Willis, holding the screen to Bruce's good, you know, whatever, he's a whistleblower, or forget that whole plot. But now, you know, you don't see David Morse as much in a lot of projects, and I don't know if it's because he's in the TV series The Outsiders, if that's eaten up his time, or what's happened.
Well, you did not see season 2 of True Detective. And this was one of the things that let you know how bad a show was you were watching, when David Morse looked uncomfortable throughout it.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Wow, really. I did not see that.
There was a great line on the Emmys tonight when the host Andy Samberg said, we said goodbye to a lot of television series this year, Mad Men, Parks and Recreation, True Detective, and True Detective's still on the air. So it lets you know, man, when you see someone who's always reliable and they are having a hard time connecting with something real, you know that there are problems on that set.
Wow. So, well, anyway, David Morse to me is my money go-to guy for character actor.
I think this is something that maybe we should spotlight a couple each week.
Yeah.
Why not keep it up? And the other guy, to put a button on it, the other guy from What We Do in the Shadows, who is really, truly a character actor, and a supporting player, is Rhys Darby. In What We Do in the Shadows, he plays the alpha dog of the werewolf pack. He's the Concords, the Flight of the Concords manager, Murray, in the show Flight of the Concords. This guy, I am so happy when this guy turns up on screen in anything that he does. He, to me, is like that golden age of Hollywood studio player guy where you go, oh, my God, it's him. I love him. Don't know his name. Love him.
Totally. And again, he's, shorter in stature. He's not Hollywood good looking per se, But man, comedy timing. And he's got the not earnestness, but the unctuousness of middle management appeal.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, he embodies middle management. And that's it. You're so right. That's it. And that is so much of the world we encounter, and yet so little of the world we see on screen.
So true. So he brings all of that just almost by just opening his mouth. It's fantastic.
It's becoming a little bit of an episode of Celebrating Things Dean Haglund Likes, and I want to continue that for just a brief second before we bring in a guest. But I'm going to do a little live event of the week that's kind of a tip of the hat to Dean Haglund.
What?
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
I saw a production, the Berkeley Rep South Coast Rep touring production of One Man, Two Governors.
Oh, you did. I did see that on Facebook, a picture of you in front of the sign there.
And
now, you know, I saw this on Broadway.
I know you did. And I had blissfully forgotten things that you'd told me, like the plants in the audience.
Oh, good.
So I'm loving this. I'm loving the seeming improv of...
Seeming improv, yes.
Oh my God. And boy, what great acting it takes to make something scripted seem like improv.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We talk about taking improv and making it seem scripted and how great that is. But this is to take scripted, make it seem like improv. And Daniel Donahue, who plays the role that was that made James Corden famous.
Right.
Daniel Donahue is every bit the equal to James Corden.
And
was all the way back when, a couple years ago during a dinner party, when I went down the hall and he gave me a wine opener, which was a show business emergency. So it turns out that guy is starring in the production that I go to see of One Man, Two Governors.
Fantastic.
And he's terrific. And so all this is great, but I'm watching it, and I'm wondering why Lily's not finding any of it funny. And
okay.
And she's watching it, though, really intently, like that, you know, trying to understand the Wall Street Journal kind of look on her face.
And, yes, exactly.
But not finding it funny at all. And she laughs. She gets in a mood, and she laughs. So I didn't understand. And suddenly it started to dawn on me, oh, this is a plant. She knows it's a plant, and she's studying the plant. Because the performance by the plant was so great. And anyway, and this is a great story. The performance, the plant, the person who played the big one, was a non-equity player who auditioned in Berkeley when the show was there. And when it went touring, because it's an equity show, they were going to replace her, the producers, with an equity performer. And the lead, Daniel Donahue, refused to go with the show unless they brought this woman along. And he didn't know this woman. He just thought that she had brought it and brought so much to their production to get it up and running that they owed her loyalty. And so there were several tense weeks while they tried to replace him, didn't find anyone who could do justice to the show. So guess what? They got him and they brought her along with them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a shocking story.
Isn't that someone showing loyalty?
Yeah. But B, also, you know, yeah, the plant is a tough thing to do. But at the same time, you have to be like you don't know what you're doing. Well, I guess that is hard.
Honestly, I would say that this performance by this plant is certainly some of the best stage work I have ever seen by a performer.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
wow.
Because again, until I cued into the reaction of the person I was with, I was terrified on behalf of this woman. I felt so bad for her. I fell for it completely.
Ah.
So
see, even up to the water.
Well, no, I mean that by then I'd already figured it out. But still, okay. You know, she's on stage for a good 20 minutes. So, you know,
that's true.
Anyway, it was an interesting show. It was a fun show. I wouldn't call it a funny show, but it was a fun show. It was a very, very fun show. One Man, Two Governors. We're going to continue the discussion of a live event of the week as soon as we come back from this.
The name of our film is
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't. Join Dean Haglund from The X-Files as he tries to learn what it means to search for the truth in a world where conspiracies or conspiracy theories are everywhere.
Nobody knows how to get out of the trouble we're in because nobody understands how it works.
And I can't learn it because...
You're never going to learn.
Unless I go to your website.
truth-is-out-there.com.
Mark Hirschhorn, are you there?
I am. I'm in beautiful...
Look at you.
I'm in beautiful Paterson, California.
Wow. I bet it's the same temperature as lovely Sydney, Australia.
It's a cool 80 degrees here at 11:15
I know.
At night.
Dear Lord, it's 80 here. I'm sweating. It's awful. But also, I love how quickly Dean turned the conversation back to Australia.
It's because you sound like you're right here, Mark. I can't believe it.
The quality's awesome. I'm on my iPhone, and I'm not even connected through Wi-Fi.
Wow. You're driving right now on the 5?
No. I was trying to find a stable place to park, and I ran into freeway construction traffic. And literally, when I got Phil's note that we were ready to go, I was pulling off the freeway. So I'm parked in a KFC parking lot in Paterson.
I know the very one. I think we stopped there.
It's right next to the Empire State Gas.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Good people, great gas. Empire State Gas. We've been discussing, we just opened up the old live event of the week discussion, and what better time to bring you in, Mark, because you're our duly designated correspondent for this year's,
congratulations,
for this year's fourth annual Los Angeles Podfest.
Absolutely. I was there not till the bitter end. I cut out early so I could get home because I've got a, Dean, you'll be interested in this. I've been tapped to, do a improvisational warm-up exercise for a bunch of strategy salespeople in the morning in San Francisco.
Wow, that is a great gig. How'd you swing that one?
They made me do it.
I see. So you're going to teach improv skills as team building, or
not really? It's just it's a big sales strategy meeting, and they just want something to energetic to warm up the morning. So
wow, what are you going to do?
Oh, you know, the usual stuff. Just, you know, some...
Do you need something energetic to warm up the morning? Ask your physician if Mark Hirschhorn's right for you.
That's right. That's right.
So, of course, people know Mark has been a guest on this show several times before. He's the internationally recognized authority and award-seeking podcast host of Succotash. He's also really one of the great minds in branding, in product branding. We talk about this from time to time. Instrumental in developing Dasani, the brand Dasani, BlackBerry, Swiffer,
yes.
Unabomber.
Unabomber? You did Unabomber? That's amazing.
And don't you, when you hear the word Unabomber, don't you picture that dude in the hoodie with the glasses automatically? Great job branding that one, Mark.
That was, yeah.
But you know, that guy never paid. Never paid.
Limbo Rock, I think, Luau, and Soda Pop. These are some of the ones you...
Also Hambone.
Hambone. Wow.
So, now, as far as I know, Dean and I did not participate again this year in LA Podfest. Did they decide to go on with the event?
Well, they did, and indeed you were represented, I'm happy to say, in the Earbuds podcast documentary, which there was a preliminary screening. They were very careful to word it, preliminary screening.
We did one of those for the Lady Killers when we did a test of it. We said, look, people, you can write about this, you can tweet about it, you can do whatever the heck you want, but you've got to say it was a preview screening, not a world premiere, because once that gets out, that status can never be pulled back. And we had, remember when John Alan Simon was on the show, Dean, and how it really affected Radio Free Album Youth, where they did a test screening and it was advertised as the world premiere. And so, you know, on IMDb, it looks like this thing was finished and out. And then 2 years later, nobody else has seen it and they wonder what's wrong with it. right?
Yeah, exactly.
So does it seem finished? Does it seem close to finished?
It is. I mean, they've got some color correction. They've probably got some a little bit of tightening. It's got a little bit of flab here and there.
But no.
Me, right? I didn't go to the gym before I was filmed.
I mean, I sense, and I have
good news and bad news about the appearance of the two of you in the movie.
Oh no!
Let's start with the good news.
So tell Dean the good news, and then you tell me the bad news.
The good news is you guys are in all three acts of the movie.
Oh, great! Hooray!
Oh no!
The bad news is we don't hear a word you say.
What?
We're literally eye candy for this movie.
Yes, you're visually represented. They cut to the two of you on mics chatting, but there's other dialogue going on sort of over you. So you are eye candy. And I even asked Chris Mancini about this, one of the producers, yesterday when I was interviewing him in the podcast lab. And I said I would be talking about the movie to the two of you tonight. And he said, tell them that there were sound problems. And then he winked.
Yeah, because we did a long interview. I mean,
yeah. But our interview was also erudite, thoughtful, well-meaning. Is that the tone of this documentary?
You know, the tone of the movie was a lot more moving than I was anticipating.
Really?
Well, the story they chose to tell, or actually several stories they chose to tell, was really sort of through the interactions of podcast listeners to shows. So there's a woman from Tokyo that's a big listener to the Mancini's
Comedy Film Nerds.
And they were talking about, she was there when they had that big earthquake several years ago. She was freaking out, and Dave Anthony was tweeting with her and trying to calm her down. And there were several other listeners to the same podcast, and so they talked about that, and I guess this woman's a longtime fan, and they actually, in the movie, they go to Tokyo and meet her face to face for the first time. And then they bring her to last year's PodFest, and she meets this other woman from the Midwest who had been going through some cancer treatments, and she'd been helping the cancer woman through things through Twitter, and they'd met through being mutual listeners to Comedy Film Nerds.
Wow.
And then there were several other stories. You know, Sean Merrick, who'd been suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Would you brand it?
Yes.
Well, I did come up with FOMA.
Or did you do non-Hodgkin's? Non-Hodgkin's. I think that's what you did.
The Hodgkin's is so popular.
We'll call it non-Hodgkin's.
But they told his story, you know, the fact he keeps working on the podcast as a producer, even though he's, you know, in the middle of chemotherapy, he's, you know, working by cell phone and stuff. And he has a happy ending in the story. His cancer's gone into full remission. And so those were the stories they chose to tell. It wasn't so much like, hey, here's a bunch of comedians that do podcasts. So, you know, the story has a lot of heart to it, which was nice.
Right.
Sounds awful.
Because we're not in it.
When are we doing our worst films of the year list, Dean? How quickly does that come up?
I will say that you and I, we all have the same amount of sound in the movie, because they actually did capture me in a few shots of the podcast lab from last year.
Well, I thought the bad news, honestly, was going to be that your associate producer, Tyson Saner, has more screen time than any of the three of us.
Well, he may. I've never seen Tyson face to face, so I don't really know exactly what he would appear as in the film.
Right.
Go ahead.
The movie follows the personal stories.
Enough about the movie.
Fans.
Who cares? Okay, why are you? But we're not even. Forget about it.
I'm going to talk to Chris about it.
Yeah, exactly. The movie's dead to me.
okay, that's all I need to hear.
You know, we did the whole show they recorded. We decided to do things from our email account or our tweet sack. Mark Hirschman.
Yes.
Just so that we would be interacting with the fans on that show that we recorded. And what good does it do, Dean? What good does it do? We give till it hurts.
I don't know.
And all it continues to do is hurt some more. But give us the State of the Union, Mark, on podcasting. Is the State of the Union strong?
I believe it is. This was certainly the most well-attended podcast festival of the four that they've done so far, to the point that I asked Chris, I said, it's looks like what happened in the Santa Monica Hotel is happening here, where you're beginning to sort of, you know, fill the place too much. And he says, yeah, we're definitely revisiting our location after this one wraps up. Cause there were lines all the way down the hall to get into some of the rooms.
Really?
Yeah. Very, wow. And you know, more podcast fans, far outstripping the podcast people.
And yet these fans knew that we weren't going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, hope springs eternal. And I think I could feel their fervent hope. They had a lot of them had signs. A lot of them had their Dean and Phil masks.
Those are selling well.
And I said, what are you going to do? Because they're not here. You have the mask. He said, well, Halloween's right around the corner. We're good.
So who was the big draws then?
Why would we promote the big draws? They don't need it. They don't need it.
That's true.
Oh my God,
no,
that's true.
Who did you interview this time, Mark? Interviews that we might get to hear on future episodes of Succotash. Who'd you interview that maybe you hadn't interviewed before and who you found really enjoyable to talk to?
You know, it's interesting because in the podcast lab, the podcasters that show up, I call them kind of the baby podcasters, because this year in particular, a lot of them, their shows have only been on for, you know, maybe a few times or maybe a year at the most. And so they get excited just interviewing each other, which is kind of strange.
But we still do.
Yeah, that's all we do.
But you guys are podcast royalty. Come on.
Yeah, right. But, yes. You know, all right. Okay.
But the occasional person of note would sweep through and they positioned me close to the door because they realized that I knew most of the podcasters. So when they saw me in there, like Greg Proops came in to say hello, and all of a sudden it was like a Roach Motel. He couldn't get out again.
So right.
He did my interview, and then he had to make the circuit around the big table and talk to like five other podcasters. So I talked to Greg Proops. I talked to Wayne Fetterman.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Chris. I talked to, let's see, who else did I talk to? All my interviews are already up. I put them all up already.
All at once.
I've numbered them all episode 116 and then just lettered them based on the order that I interviewed people. So there's six interviews from this weekend that I just put up on succotashshow.com.
Wow, look at you being all proactive.
Well, I realized if I could sit there and work on getting the next episode up, then the baby podcasters wouldn't talk to me.
Yeah.
So what's the word on the street? What's the word coming out of the lab about the future of podcasting? How might this be changing?
I definitely think there's this growing network of networks springing up. It seems like every week there's more and more networks of podcasts, and some of them of significant note. So that seems to be on the rise.
So I should start responding to these emails from networks.
Yes, definitely.
Because we got burned
on our network.
Yeah,
what happened? We
were on a network back in. We say this show began in May of 2007. When I say this show, I mean your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Of course, it was called From the Heart of Hollywood, but we say it began in May of 2007 because that's when we got picked up by the Farpoint Media Network.
All right.
And then at some point, I guess our numbers weren't what they wanted, so we could stay with them if we paid them. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And a month after that, they wiped clean our site.
That's right.
Our fortunately. As the months had led up to this, I had sensed some very squirrely behavior on their part, so of course I'd backed everything up. But it took a long time, as you know, to rebuild the full archive, the vault the vault of genius, as it's known in earbuds, if you could hear us speak.
the Chill Pack Library at Alexandria.
Yeah, exactly. Burnt to the ground. Humanity set back
all that's left standing is the KFC right next door.
That's right.
So networks, it's all in network. Weren't we talking about starting a network a while back?
We were, but then you went with Blog Talk and all those talks crashed. Nothing happened.
Oh, well, it's still never too late.
It's always never too late. It's always exactly. It's always not never too late.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, it's not never too late. Yeah, that's right. I was just writing that
what
down,
about so, yeah. What about the shows that you saw? What seemed to be? Did you discover any that
No, I mean there were no surprise. I didn't really attend many of the shows because they're all podcasts that I know of, and kind of watching shows that are built for an audio medium just sort of don't really do much for me. It's
right.
Kind of like, wow, what's the deal? There's no staging. There's nothing to. I'm watching what the guy does at home. Except
yeah.
He's in front of a bunch of people. So there was kind of nothing new. There was kind of the last gasp of like the Thrilling Adventure Hour, which basically, you know, they shuttered their operation, but they still show up for these kind of events once in a while. But they closed down their little show after 10 years.
Well,
because
one of them moved to Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing like that to kill a show.
Well, no, they've done this live stage show for 10 years, and the podcast was really just an offshoot of that. They would just chop it up into bits and put that out. And so that the show actually ended like 8 months ago, but they had so much of so much left over that they've been doling it out over the weeks since then. But they finally ran out of that material. So they were done with. But the usual suspects were there, you know, the Mark Marins and Greg Proops and all those people.
Right.
And again, because of the lack of space, they've only got kind of the three rooms they could put shows up in the podcast lab. So there wasn't anywhere else to put shows up. So they're maxed out as far as what they were showing.
And then nobody was in the lobby or anything like that?
No, there was no real space there to do it. And they had one small room where they were doing, you know, the panels. And I didn't go to see any of them because they were all the same sort of things, like, you know, how do you monetize your podcast and that sort of
That's
thing.
That's a hilarious show. Yeah. I love that. I don't miss that show. Every week.
I was going to open up a hospitality suite for Henderson's Pants. So I thought that would be a good one.
Ah, I see that.
You know, we've spoken of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club here on the show. And of course, when Lily and Karen Foreman were guest hosting for us, and preparing their show, Am I Right, Ladies? They talked about it as well. I'm going to be actually joining as a member of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, and one of the things that I'm going to bring to it is I'm going to do a Los Angeles Breakfast Club podcast. God, I sound like I'm setting everybody up for a joke, but I'm not.
I know.
No, this is actually real, because one of the things that has always excited me was that, of course, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, now in its 90th year, was for several years back, 20s, 30s, 40s, was broadcast nationwide on radio, the second hour every week. And they have all of this on vinyl. All these shows.
Oh, yeah.
And so I thought, what a fun podcast to do each week. All it seems to me you'd need to do is, you know, do an interview with one of the members that have been there for many, many years. Hear some stories about that. Tell about, you know, maybe on this date in history at the Breakfast Club. Do one of the, you know, a sample from one of those legendary shows. Here's Jimmy Durante performing in, you know, 1935 or whatever. And then have the current entertainment do a piece.
That's a great idea.
So, you know, a Los Angeles Breakfast Club podcast, you've got your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. When Lily and Karen are doing Am I Right, Ladies? You've got Succotash Interviews and Clips Show. How do we not already have a network right there?
Yeah, it sounds like a network to me.
Okay, fantastic. So we need now is a giant server.
Right. Now, once you join the Breakfast Club, will you teach Dean and I the secret handshakes?
I thank you for bringing this up. I can't believe this. I've been meaning to bring this up with Dean, the seer of all things conspiratorial. We were researching historic pictures on the internet of you know, the Breakfast Club to see if we could create some new slides to show in the morning, you know, and we found a great photo of Ronald Reagan's swearing-in ceremony in the 60s. There's Ronald Reagan. So I guess he would have been governor then.
Yeah.
Being sworn in while he's astride, what's the horse's name?
Yeah, was it Old Betsy?
Ham. No,
it was...
Ham the horse.
Yeah.
So he's astride Ham the horse. He's blindfolded. His hand is in a plate of eggs. And and that's the swearing-in ceremony. But anyway, where do we find this? But it's on a conspiracy theorist's website, and the photo is proof about how all presidents are members of secret societies, and these secret societies are up to no good. So the Breakfast Club plays into this conspiracy theory. This cabal. You've been there. You've been there, Dean, and the first thing you thought when you saw these 80- and 90-year-old nurses and dentists and real estate agents was this cabal is trying to ruin the world.
Sinister, yeah, I thought.
You have to let us know when they put you through the ritual of the Whispering Sands, Phil. Which they will do.
Okay.
We cannot wait.
Will that be a live event of the week as well? Hey, we've got a we're at the end of an hour of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour,
holy
so we're gonna have to let you go. But the other thing we talked about on this show, Mark, was we're basically making each week a celebration of the art of character actors, supporting performers, but really character actors. They can bounce back and forth from support in today's economic climate. You have to be able to go back and forth from leads to supporting. You got to go where the roles are. And I was wondering if when you hear that word character actor, if there's any contemporary performers that come to mind for you.
Yes, immediately. Clancy Brown.
Oh.
Clancy Brown.
You know what that Clancy Brown is in? Is in 99 Homes, which he's... have been raving about because of Michael Shannon. But you're absolutely right, and it brought me such joy when he was on screen.
His turn in, which arguably is either just a silly, horrible movie or just kind of a really cool, bizarre movie, Highlander, was fantastic as the Kurgan.
He's my favorite in Buckaroo Banzai.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've seen him in a lead. I've seen him on TV, and he can do anything.
Isn't he in the guard in Shawshank Redemption?
Yes.
The pilot episode of the TV series Sleepy Hollow, which manages to be both.
Yes.
He is the one thing worth watching, and then he gets beheaded, so I knew I didn't have to watch anymore. So,
well, no, except he's throughout the series.
What?
They have flashbacks and stuff to him.
But you're not. We've lost the connection with Mark Hirschhorn. All right, gents, I got to button this up.
All right.
Fantastic.
But you know, Mark, you can find so many installments of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com.
I think you know that, Mark.
I'll go there now.
You could. You can download them and stream them, and you can subscribe via iTunes.
You can even write a review, Mark.
People can write us on Facebook, Dean, at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. That's the email.
Yeah, Facebook. That's the email. You can find us at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Oh, thank you for correcting that. Yes.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean M. Phil.
How can people find you, Mark Hirschhorn?
Succotashshow.com, at succotashshow on Twitter.
Wow.
So easy.
It's as easy as that. Thank you for all the wonderful shows that you've done, Mark, but especially for inventing the term riboflavin.
My pleasure.
All right. That's Mark Hirschhorn. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you guys.
Thanks, gentlemen.
See you, gents. Thanks. Intercontinental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.